Welcome to LILAS, the Teresa Lozano Long Institute of Latin American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. This is LILAS Associate Director Juliet Hooker, and I'd like to invite you to listen to the podcast of this important event held recently at the Institute. We have begun posting podcasts of many of our public events online in order to make more of the rich variety of our outstanding programming on Latin America available to a wider audience beyond the university. We hope you find them informative and enjoyable. Please come back and listen to more of what we do at LILAS.
In today's presentation about the perils of human activity, lessons from Colombians' experience with soil erosion, is actually not my title. If you see that title is good because it's not mine. It's Jonathan's title, the intern here in LILAS. He adapted my first title, so it's a quite good one because this is what I want to show you in this presentation. I will divide this talk in three sections. The first one, I will give you some background of the importance of erosion in drainage basins. How do we measure erosion from rivers? And then a quick look of the geographical setting of the Andes of South America for those who are not familiar with the subject. And the second part, I will go into some results we found about the main natural and human-induced drivers on erosion in the northern Andes of South America. And last, I will show you some facts on the way Latin American countries, and especially Colombia, are facing climate change. And in the way our countries are facing natural disasters as floods and landslides. Because the point I want to make, and you will see it later on in the talk, is that the all policymakers are blaming, are saying that the main cause of floods and landslides is climate change. So it's a common excuse right now in Latin American countries, everything is climate change. But the human impact on soils and land is not the cause, it's climate change. So all mitigation and adaptation policies are focused on climate change, but not on our impact on land. So finally, that's the point I want to make in the presentation. Well, rivers are very important in shaping the landscape we see. They erode channels, they transport sediments, solutes, pollutants from natural processes or from human activities, and they produce a wide range of erosional and depositional forms. Actually, rivers are the primary agents of erosion. So the amount of sediments transported by river is a measure to link to the amount of erosion on land. Why do we study erosion from rivers? Well, erosion is an important or key component of the global denudation process on land. And erosion is also very important for different studies, for example, landscape evolution, geochemical and mass balance, net erosion intensities and desertification processes, land use changes and associated drivers like agriculture, mining, urbanization. It's also a key information for understanding the impacts of past land use or climate changes. And keep in mind that erosion has many consequences in terms of money, because erosion brings sedimentation on channels. Erosion, so you need to dredge those channels and invest money. Erosion is also linked with floods, and landslides. So it has an indirect cost with the associated cost with the environmental issues. In any given catchment, so one of the main incomes or forces shaping or driving erosion is the precipitation or the water balance in that river. Water balance in terms of the precipitation we get minus the evaporation on land. So right now here in Texas, we are having a negative water balance because it's too much evaporation, but no rain at all. So in as you will see in the talk, so in regions like the Andes of northern South America, we have high rainfall rates, so we have a lot of water available to erode the land. And there are also other components which are very important, the rock type in the drainage basin, because not all rocks are easily eroded. It depends on the rock type and the lithology of the soils. So what we do to measure the amount of sediment coming from any given river is that we collect information at the most downstream hydrological gauging station from all, let's say, from the hydrological institutes in any country. For example, here, these gauging stations in the States are run by the USGS, United States Geological Survey. So what these guys do is that they sample a cross-section in the river, and they measure water discharge, volume of water passing through the cross-section in any given time, per second, for example, cubic meters. They measure the water level, and they also measure the sediment concentration passing through that cross-section. And they build this kind of equations or relationships between concentration and the amount of water passing in that section. So if they go to the river, they measure, for example, during dry periods, during intermediate precipitation periods, and during high rainfall periods. And they build, or they come up with these kind of equations which are called calibration curve or rating curves. Then with this curve and having the water level and the water discharge, they project or interpolate the sediment discharge of that river in time using that equation. I would just want here to show you the main drivers on erosion in drainage basins. Those are basically natural forces as climate, morphology in terms of topography, the geology of the drainage basin, which means the type of the soils, rocks, the tectonism of the region, and also hydrologic characteristics like the runoff, precipitation, and so on. And there are also other anthropogenic influences, which are mainly land conversion or land use due to agricultural practices, due to mining, due to road construction, due to urbanization also. So all those human activities related to the mobilization of sediments. So in the lowest point of any given river, let's say the outlet of the river, let's say another river or the ocean, in deltas, estuaries, bays, so the amount of sediment we get at the lowest point is the expression or the net result of the whole processes occurring upstream of that station. South America, well, this is an interesting continent because the Andes mountain range gives to the continent a large asymmetry, which means that 78% of all South American rivers drain to the Atlantic, but also almost, but only 22% of the rivers drain to the Pacific, which means that towards the east we have large drainage basins, but on the west we have short rivers with small drainage basins. In terms of the northern Andes, which is our region of study for this presentation, once the Andes comes into Ecuador, in the border between Ecuador and Colombia, it divides in three branches: the western, central, and eastern cordilleras, called cordilleras. These are mostly, all these cordilleras are mostly in Colombia. So this is a quite interesting place because there are interesting and complex region, because there are many physical factors that are occurring in this region. Let's say the first one is located in the intertropical convergence zone, which is a cloudy band of high precipitation around the globe in the tropics, and it's due to the convergence of the northeast trade winds and southeast trade winds. So this condition, the presence of the intertropical convergence zone, brings a lot of rainfall in the region as well as around the world. Also, it is surrounded by many basins. So let's say on the west, we have the Pacific Ocean, and we have the influence of the ENSO, El Niño and the Southern Oscillation, El Niño and La Niña events. On the north, it is surrounded by the Caribbean Basin, and we have a lot of influence of low pressure system in terms of storm and hurricanes from the Caribbean. In the south, is surrounded by the Amazon Basin. Actually, Colombia has part of the Amazon Basin. I think it's 77% of the Amazon Basin is in Colombia, somehow. And then on the east is the Orinoco Basin, which is Venezuela over here. So we get the ENSO, the influence of climatic anomalies from El Niño and La Niña from the west, low pressure from here, dry systems from the Orinoco, and humid and cold systems from the Amazon. So it's a quite diverse climatic region. Let's talk about some rainfall regimes here in the northern Andes. So we could have here 14,000 millimeters per year, which is the highest rainfall on the western hemisphere here in Chocó. We could have here on the Pacific, let's say 11,000 millimeters per year. We could have here in the mountain ranges from 6,000 up to down to 500 millimeters. So you see a quite variability of climatic conditions. This is a database of tectonic movements or seismic events in the region in the last 8 years. So you see that with magnitude higher than 4, so it's a quite very active tectonic region, plus steep slopes, all these rivers. So sea level rises associated with the ENSO and a lot of erosion on the coast. Anyway, so there are many, 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 many interesting combinations. So when we checked the information available of erosion on global databases like this, available many years ago, many of these databases were losing the picture of the Andean rivers. Actually, when you see all of these databases, are the only guys who that were sampled are the Amazon, Paraná, Magdalena, Orinoco, Amazon, and Paraná. But all these rivers from the western South America and all the Andean rivers, still, we don't have the picture of the amount of erosion of Andean rivers in the global view. So we became interested, okay, which are the erosion rates in the Andean rivers and which are the main natural and human-induced processes driving these erosion rates. So we started collecting data from many, many downstream stations on the Pacific rivers and Caribbean rivers, and came up with kind of this budget of sediment load of erosion from the Andean rivers, and also used some interpolation models for engaged rivers to estimate the total sediment load into the Pacific or into the Caribbean, and also the sediment erosion rate. I forgot to mention, that erosion is measured in tons per square kilometers per time, per year. So if you divide the total amount of sediment transport per area of the drainage basin, you get the amount of sediments in mass per area per time. So this is called sediment yield. But for the purposes of this talk, we will call it erosion. Okay? Unit mass per area per time. And then we became interested in the largest fluvial system of the Andes, which is the Magdalena River, and is the most important source of sediments into the Caribbean Sea. The Magdalena shares, although the Magdalena is a medium-sized river, it shares many important characteristics with other big guys like the Orinoco, Amazon, São Francisco, and Paraná. So these are the main rivers draining into the eastern seaboard of South America. Although the Magdalena enters into the Caribbean, it could be considered that it enters into the Atlantic seaboard because the Caribbean Sea is a basin of the Atlantic Ocean. And when we look at the Magdalena, we wonder, okay, this is a world-class river with 150 million tons per year. It could be in the top 15 rivers in terms of sediment transport. And when we compare the erosion rate of the Magdalena with these big guys in South America, it is quite evident that the erosion from the Magdalena is many fold larger or greater than the other big guys. Mm. Well, why is this? So we wanted to explore the natural and anthropogenic causes of this erosion in the northern Andes and see relationships between land use and transit erosion and see how human activities are impacting the amount of erosion in the region, and then discuss some underlying drivers of the observed trends in erosion. We collected the multi-year measurements of sediment transport, water discharge for more than 40 sites in the northern Andes. And for every river, we measured all available natural variables in terms of morphology, topography, climate, and hydrology, and built and performed some correlation calculations to come up with some explaining statistical models on erosion and see which natural factors control erosion. We also assess the effect of anthropogenic influence by making land cover change analysis between the late 70s and mid 90s and see if we could include the anthropogenic impact or explain the amount of variance in erosion explained by the human activities. When we look at these GIS databases of the main physical attributes of or in the region, we see that in terms of, for example, elevation, steepness, and precipitation, amount of rainfall, we see that there is a quite large variability. For example, from dry regions up to very, very humid regions with more than 5,000 millimeters per year, and few hundreds millimeters per year. And this quite strong variability is reflected in the strong variability of erosion. So looking at the frequency distribution of erosion in all these rivers, there are a few of them that are grouped away from the main distribution, looking at this histogram. So all these guys are mainly due on the eastern side, are highly impacted by mining. I will show you later on. And our models, I'm not going to go into much detail with this because this is too much numbers and so on, and it's not the purpose for it's not the convenient for this talk. But the main variables explaining 58% of the erosion in the whole northern Andes basin are runoff and maximum water discharge, which means that these rivers are controlled by climate and hydrology in terms of the surface water available for erosion. So it's a quite interesting relationship. I'm not going to go into much detail, but this is the important stuff that I'm going to mention from here just to the end of the talk, and it's land use change. These are land cover maps developed from 45 Landsat multispectral scanner and Landsat thematic mapper images in the late 70s and 90s. And we came up with 11 clusters. And in general, the forest cover decreased by almost 40% in 20 years. Look, the color green, the green color here, and the white and yellow color here. So most of that deforestation was converted into agricultural land and cattle ranching land. So almost all agricultural lands doubled their area during the time period, which is an amazing deforestation rate. When we looked at some other economic activities and the participation on the GDP, of the national GDP, these activities are well known that they are linked with erosion, which is mining, industry, construction, and sea. See the increase, for example, in 15 years, many folds in construction, in mining. So there is a quite evident increase in economic activities related with land deterioration. This is a look of the old mining combined in the northern Andes and during the last 60 years. And it's evident that we get an increase, a markedly increase from the 80s or late 70s. Which is evident for coal, for example, and gold mining. Also, we look at the time series variability of sediment transport from all these rivers, and I only show a few of them. The most important one, and the second largest Andean river, is the Cauca. And this river saw his sediment load increase by somehow 30% in the last 20 years. Other rivers show increases, for example, from the middle 80s. These increases in sediment transport or erosion are well linked with the increases in economic activities. So what we were missing is, okay, we have now explained the amount of erosion due to natural processes. So how can we explain the amount of erosion due to human activities? And this is important, you know, and especially here talking with the students. Guys, this is important because when you talk to policymakers, you need to tell them, look, this is what we are doing with our soils, and this is the cost of this. So we wanted to come up with a kind of number of explanation of the human activities on the erosion in the Northern Andes. So we downscaled the analysis presented before and wanted to develop a deforestation index, a very precise deforestation index with land use changes, and include that deforestation index in a very successful model developed by University of Colorado, which this is the group called Community CSDMS, which stands for Community Surface Dynamic Modeling System. I could say that this is one of the five top groups right now in the world working in numerical modeling of Earth surface processes. So what these guys did is that they included in a global model, they predicted erosion for almost 500 big rivers in the world. And this is a quite good model. Look at the fitness and the explained variance, 95%. And what they accomplished in this model is that they included lithology, global lithology, but also GDP. GDP, gross domestic product, at country level. Why GDP? Well, the human capability to alter soils or land surface could be measured by, or the human impact could be measured by the amount of people living in a certain region multiplied by the economic and technical capacities of that people. So that kind of relationship is well described by GDP, which is economy. So we apply that model, that global model, into the Magdalena together with the University of Colorado and some NASA funds for global desertification. So what this model says is that erosion, yes, it's sediment load, but we can call it erosion. Erosion can be predicted or modeled with this equation. This is a constant or a calibration value. I'm not going to work. This is a B value, which is this one. And this is Q, which is water discharge in that river. This is A, area of the river, or size of the drainage basin. This is R, which is relief, or the maximum altitude in that drainage basin. And this is average temperature for the whole basin. So that return is split in L, which is lithology, the type of soils in that basin, but also trapping efficiency. And this is very important because trapping efficiency means dams, because dams trap sediments. So if you have a dam before the gauging station, of course you are going to get less sediments in your measurement because those sediments are being trapped in dams. But also we have natural dams as floodplains. So, and then they came up with a factor which is called anthropogenic factor. This is the GDP one. So since we didn't have GDP at the rural scale in the Andes, we came up with a different anthropogenic indicator for this model. We calculated for the whole rivers, the lithology factor based on the geology map of Colombia. We also use this deforestation index widely used in tropical assessments. We came up with this kind of calculation of deforestation and included this deforestation index in the GIS databases of the northern rivers, and then came up with the anthropogenic factor of our rivers. So this is the erosion factor expressed here for all northern Andes river, and overall there is 78% of all Northern Andes River are experiencing a strong erosion rates, 70%, 78%, sorry. And once we included, let's see the model the simulated or predicted erosion and the observed. And let's see the fitness of the mode. This is the fitness without including the anthropogenic factor. But once we included the anthropogenic factor, the fitness is very good. Actually, the model explains 82% of the whole variance in erosion, which means, in other words, that human activities in terms of deforestation explain 32% of the observed variance in erosion. Well, this number has strong consequences and huge consequences at the policy making level. Let's see how other global assessments have seen the Northern Andes, for example. This is a study by Carmen Revenga and collaborators from the World Resources Institute in Washington, and this is called Pilot Analysis of Drainage Basins. This is a exquisite piece of work. But look that this is a large scale. So you lose the fine grain of the analysis once you go to zoom out like this. But these are in Spanish, but for example, the Northern Andes, according to this assessment, experienced 90% of forest cover because before human settlements, which was, let's say, 2 centuries ago. Average. Anyway. But one of the basins having more forest loss is the Northern Andes. Look like the population density in the Northern Andes is the highest of all South American drainage basins. So together with the Alexander von Humboldt Institute of Biodiversity in Colombia, which is a good institute working on biodiversity with the funds from GF, with funds from GEF, from the government and other institutions, we developed the map of ecosystems in the Northern Andes at sea in 2005. So only 5% of primary forest remain in the region. This is quite dramatic. This is. So let's keep in mind that we used to analyze river like in different compartments. I mean, upper basin, middle basin, downstream basin, and the coast. So, for example, from my own experience in Colombia, if you are a marine biologist, stop there. You are not allowed to work in the mountains because you are marine biologists. You are not geologists. Oh, you are geologists, but you are not marine geologists. So please, keep away of the delta or the coastal zone because you are not marine geologists. Okay? And in that way, we have treated rivers. It's like, okay, you guys deal with the upper stuff. We will deal with the down stuff. But the system is a continuum system, connected system, upstream and downstream. Excuse me for these rude words. All the shit you get downstream is from upstream. So this is a clear connection in all these boxes, a continuum connection. So all what you get in the floodplains of the river and downstream is part of properties, natural factors that alter soils and transport from the river, but also human activities. So there is a quite interesting loop followed by many, many global assessments. This is IGBP, for example, International Geosphere Biosphere Program, which is a global program of the International Council of Science. And is that we have socioeconomic drivers, but also environmental pressures, which altogether create state of changes in the systems. Let's say in the river, within the basin, but also in the coastal zone. So looking at this relation in another way, This is a IGBP figure which shows the unidirectional path of fluxes in any river. So all what you produce in the upper basin, you will see it in the floodplains and also in the coastal zone or where that river empties into the other river. But the point I want to make is that these floodplains in river or wetlands. So in most of the rivers, in lowlands, before the river empty into another fluvial system or into the coast, we have these kind of guys. Sorry for those who are, you know, well familiar with this, but this is an open audience, and this is an important point. And the relation I want to make between erosion, sedimentation, and floods, natural disasters that we are just experiencing in Latin America. And it's this one. In the floodplains, low floodplains, these are quite nice containers of water. They absorb water. The storage capacity of these lakes or wetlands depend on what? On that if you bring too much sediments from upstream, you create a lot of sedimentation and reduce the storage capacity of water in these lakes. So if you increase erosion or sedimentation rates in here, you reduce the storage capacity of water. And then you increase the occurrence of floods in the region. Of course, because then you have less storage capacity. So in the northern Andes, all these rivers meet in this region before they go into the ocean. And this region is called the Mompox Tectonic Depression. Mompox is a name of a historical city in Colombia. And let me tell you that Mompox is most beautiful than Cartagena. And Mompox is much older than Cartagena. And actually, Simón Bolívar began his campaign in Mompox. It's a beautiful, beautiful and gorgeous place. But now is experiencing a lot of floods, and the old houses are just going down because of the humidity, floods, and so on. But the point I want to make is that this region are accumulating huge amounts of sediment produced in the upper basin. So what are the consequences of these sedimentation trends in the observed pattern of floods in Colombia, for example? This is a Google image. You see the river. This is the Magdalena. This is the Mompox city. Cartagena is over here in the Caribbean. So this is a huge floodplain, lowland plain, with extensive lakes, almost 2,000 square kilometers in area. And this is a very important sponge to control floods. Actually, the main cities of Colombia, Barranquilla, Cartagena, Mompox, and others, are still there because we have this buffer filtering all high levels of water and so on. So our first models indicated this ellipse represents that region, that Mompox region. So some preliminary approximation of the conceptual model of erosion in sediment transport from the northern Andes showed us that approximately 14% of the sediment from the basin is trapped in that region. But with more good calculations, and in this work with NASA and University of Colorado, this is a digital elevation figure. NASA with 30 meters of pixel, not 90 meters, 30 meters of spatial resolution, and 1 meter of elevation. It shows the whole floodplain of the region Each color represents a meter difference in altitude. So, well, when we see all these lagoons, when we see all these lagoons, we believe, oh, they are at the same altitude, and they are not, which means that not all lakes or lagoons are connected with the main fluvial system. This is important because, as you see here, in some, as a zoom, let's take a zoom over that region, in some MODIS NASA satellite images, not all lagoons get sediments from the river. This is a turbid one, but this is a clear one. Mm. So with the analysis and many slaves, we analyzed 300 MODIS NASA images from the La Niña in 2008 and came up with a number of the probable number of the amount of sediment trapped in the region, which is between 20 and 40, 45% of the sediment produced in the upper basin from erosion, let's say natural or human-driven erosion, are trapped in that region. These are some MODIS NASA images. This is a composite of many images. This is the floods in the region during November 2004. This is the difference between November and February 2005 during the same La Niña event. La Niña means wetter conditions than normal. El Niño means drier conditions than normal. And let's see La Niña 2008. In color is the amount of the floods we got in the region. And La Niña 2010. Which was the worst on record in Colombia. I will refer to that at the end of the next section of the meeting. So when we observed a calibration between the satellite and the water discharge at some station in that region, we see that we have kind not cyclical behavior, but not periodic one, but it's been kind of up and downs. But the last floods in 2010, they were bigger in magnitude and in time.
Why is that?
We don't know still. But the connection I want to make here is that, what this is about? What is the use of all this information in terms of mitigation, adaptation, in terms of natural disasters. So the Colombian floods, just last year, 2010-11, were called by the Colombian government the rain wave. These were the worst floods on record, more than 3 million people homeless, 400 deaths, people killed, more than $14 billion in losses in infrastructure, schools, towns, roads, bridges. It's been the worst. Actually, it's been worse than the earthquake we have on the Coffee region in 1987, and it was worse than the volcanic eruption we have in the Nevado del Ruiz, in the Armero, during the 80s, mid 80s. So, in addition to other issues in Colombia, I just mentioned them here: violence, war against drugs and guerrillas, because you know how much money we invest fighting drugs and guerrilla in Colombia is approximately 40% of the national GDP. It's a lot of money. So we have to use that money fighting these guys. So besides foreign investments, because we are calling investment mining companies and calling everybody, come and invest in Colombia, unemployment, among others, the Colombian government will invest, just to recover the region, the whole North Andean, approximately 10% of the national GDP. And this is a lot of money for us. And there are some critical concerns about the use of that money, which is corruption, is the most common one. We got the most famous cases of corruption in Colombia in the health system and in other part of the government just a few months ago. And all of those corruption issues were from the Uribe president. And we were thinking, all Colombians, that Uribe was great. Oh, he saved us. But he led the country with a lot of issues and problems in terms of corruption. Then, lack of technical and scientific studies regarding feasibility of ongoing works. So the country is saying, please, fix the bridge, fix the road, yeah, now, we need money. But we wonder if we fix those roads and bridges, maybe in the next La Niña, in 3 years, they will be gone again. Probably. So it's time to, okay, easy. Let's think, how are we going to invest this money? First, we need scientific studies about the flooding regions, the hydrological behavior of the rivers, about what we are doing with our soils, so on. So, the president of Colombia, this is not the president, the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, the current one, said, okay, this is a lot of money. So I need to create a new institution of a new organism called a new institutional one called Colombia Humanitaria. This is the institution that is going to administer the whole fund to recover, adaptation, mitigation, future studies, and so on. But I won't give that. I won't put on the head of that institution any politician. So he called the president of the largest private bank in Colombia and told him, "Okay, I need you here, and you are going to administer all these funds. No politics here." So this is the Constitutional Court. So when we're having these floods, and in order to get the money from the national budget, the Constitutional Court issued many emergency decrees. Decrees, is that okay? Mm-hmm. Or laws. So those decrees were to put the government on a state of emergency. And with those decrees, allow the government to get the funds from the national budget. Okay, until now, the story goes fine, goes okay. But the Colombian government is arguing that the increased magnitude and frequency of flood, landslides, and natural disasters related to soils are due to climate change. So it's not deforestation, it's not mining, blah, 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 it's climate change. Thus, our hypothesis that we are just now working and doing lobbying with the government and presenting all of this stuff, our hypothesis is not rocket science, but this is applied science. Our hypothesis is that, well, an increase in land deterioration or soil deterioration, a remarkable increase in the soil degradation could show an increased trend in erosion, and thus increasing trends in floods and landslides. And I just got this one from the web, from some friends, and I'm going to translate this for you. This is a kind of a joke. I don't know if this is real or is a joke, but I just got it, and I want to translate this for you. This is gorgeous.
This is great. And this is to make a joke about the hydrological institutions in our countries, because the point I want to make is that they are biased. They follow political orders and political reasons. For example, we were saying even 2000 that La Niña was still present in Colombia, and La Niña wasn't. And it, you know why? The Hydrological Institute was lying. And you know why? Because the government was pushing the Hydrological Institute and needed more money, because we got other floods here in 2000, not the ones, the worst ones in last year, and needed more emergency decrees to get more money. So the Hydrological Institute kept saying, yes, we are in La Niña. And according to NOAA, all projections from NOAA, we were measuring the Pacific waters with the Colombian Navy. I was in that oceanographic cruise in January, and La Niña was almost gone in January. But still in March and April, in April this year, the government was still saying, it's La Niña, La Niña, La Niña. So the credibility of this institution is quite, I doubt about sometimes about the information in this institution. So this is called, look at this in Bolivia, this is called Integrated System, Popular Integrated System of Meteorology. 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 There we are. Okay. And it says, this is the condition, this is a stone hanging from a pope, okay, in front of the sign. And it says, condition and prediction, based on the stone. Okay. This is a meteorological station, gauging station. It's gorgeous. Look, the stone is wet, the condition, so the prediction is that rainy weather. The stone is dry, the condition is dry weather. There is a shadow on the floor, so the condition is sunny. No shadow on the floor, cloudy. The stone is jumping. Oh, we got an earthquake. The stone is not there. We got a hurricane. You don't see the stone, it's at night. You see the stone, it's the day. Gorgeous. Well, sorry if there is any Bolivian here, but this is also the case in Colombia. Well, I just want to bring some facts about the let's see the other side of the coin with global information from different assessments and so on. The relation between climate change and precipitation trends. There is no clear relationship on Earth right now on trends between climate change and precipitation. This is IPCC, for example, 2000. Look, the whole South American region, missing all dots, not good prediction. This is a very, very difficult region to model in numerical models, because all these combinations, intertropical convergence, different ranges of mountains, Amazon, Caribbean, Pacific, Papa. Look, and this is a map of the projected precipitation trends based on IPCC. IPCC is International Panel of Climate Change. This is the same map Diana Lieberman, Professor Lieberman, was showing in her presentation in Lilas a few weeks ago. And the models failed to predict precipitation trends in Latin America. That's period. Well, connections between El Niño and La Niña and climate change. There is no clear link between El Niño and La Niña and climate change. Actually, let's talk about hurricanes. Still, there is not clear scientific evidence about the link between hurricanes and climate change. Yes, the oceans are getting warmer and so on and so on and so on, but the magnitude and frequency is still not well understood right now. The same with El Niño and La Niña. We have had strong El Niños before. It's strong. And back in time with the paleo records of sediments in Peru, in Bolivia, in Colombia, we have seen that we have had in the past before climate change, before fossil fuels and so on, we have had strong El Niños and La Niña. So the link is not still evident. Sorry, this is in Spanish, but it's in English too. There is a new term going on. Many scientists are arguing that if we are still living in the Holocene, which is the stable geological epoch that began 10,000 years ago, are we still in the Holocene? So they are arguing that we are living, not living anymore in the Holocene, we are living in the Anthropocene, which is the age of man. So there is a quiet debate about this, but this is GDP. So the human impact, the factor of human impact, could be measured, the capability of humans to alter land could be measured as the amount of people living in a given region, multiply, as I mentioned before, multiply by the capacities, economic capacities and technological capacities to alter the soils. So that's GDP. And this is a National Geographic issue many months ago, this year. But let's see this one. Sorry for that scratch over there. I just took out the price tag. I didn't realize it was going to be used later on. This is a quite excellent and gorgeous article in The Economist. It was a few months ago. It's about the welcome to the Anthropocene. And basically, what this article says is that the International Commission of Stratigraphy, which is the final adjudicator of the geological time scale, is taking interest in considering, formal interest in considering in considering naming this new era as a geological in the geological time scale and as a new geological era. Well, the Anthropocene is not new. March talked about that in 1856. Stoppani called it Anthropozoic. Well, Brown in 1956 came with the term of technological denudation. And then Crutzen, which is a very famous atmospheric scientist, said, okay, I'm not longer living in the Holocene. I'm living in the age of the man. So there is a quite debate interesting about this. So what's going on? We have drivers, we have pressure, we have impact, and we have response in any given system. This is quite a framework used in global assessments. So population, technology, and economy, more intervention on the land, impact changes in processes and sensitivity of subsoil. Once we cut off forests, all uncovered soils become less resilient to erosion. So we reduce the resilience or resistance of the soils. So for the same amount of water, of precipitation, we create more surface runoff because less water is infiltrated. Thank you, Carlos, into the soil. So for the same precipitation, we get more water into the channels, and then more floods. This is the International Disaster Database. I advise you to check at this. This is a very gorgeous database until 2010. It's a clear exponential growth of global disasters. It can be due to two reasons. One, that databases on disasters are more consistent in recent times because of the communications and so on. Okay, That's one. And the other one, that our impact on land surface is there. So there is a kind of a signal there of our influence. These are flags taken from the database. We just got the flags. This is a... Then let's see slides. These are the publications, sorry. What we mentioned before. And this is the precipitation according to IPCC. There is no clear pattern of precipitation increase or decrease. In fact, only between 2 and 7% of the whole globe is experiencing precipitation trends. It's a few amount of increase for the whole Earth. So it's not that climate change is increasing trends of precipitation. It's not well understood. So climate change does not explain the trends in floods. Could be GDP. This is a nice figure from a colleague, Antonio Sendrero. He's a good friend of Eduardo. I just met him a few months ago and was working with him. And this is the natural disaster of different spatial scales. So this is a town in Spain. This is Italy, just a country. And this is the global one. So you can see the good fitness or relation at different spatial scales. But take a look here. Keep an eye here on floods. So the steepness is more markedly in floods than in other natural disasters. Could be the human signal here. This is a database of the Northern Andes of landslides and floods. We are just working on this GIS database. We don't have databases of natural disasters in Colombia. Actually, we are a country like China and other places. We are a country of natural disasters. We are a country of earthquakes, we are a country of a lot of rain, we are a country of floods, and eruptions, volcanic eruptions, but we don't have any organism or governmental institution taking care of disasters. That's amazing. But we have a lot of bureaucracy, but not even having this. Not even linked to the environment ministry of environment. Well, these are preliminary calculations. This is the variation of erosion in some two important rivers in the Northern Andes. This is the overall increase in erosion and increase in runoff or water discharge. This another river shows increase in erosion and increase in water discharge, the amount of water carried by every river. But when we check precipitation trends in different stations in this river, there is no precipitation trend at all. So it's not precipitation. So we are getting more water in the rivers, but the same amount of precipitation. What's going on? Well, could be the resilience of soils against erosion. This is another database of mining in Colombia in the Northern Andes. Look at the steep increase from the 80s. Well, this is a former ex-president of the Republic Bank of Colombia. This is an assessment of the increase in cattle ranching in the country. And look, from 16 million to 56 million hectares in 2000. Amazing increase. Most of these lands are deforested lands. Well, cocaine. Of course, cocaine is included in the deforestation trends, but cocaine alone is a deforestation driver itself. These are cocaine, forest clearance due to cocaine crops. These are landslides occurred in this cocaine region in the Cauca River. Look at all the scars on land due to cocaine. Look at all these scars. Desertification after all cocaine crops are abandoned, or after all these cocaine are devastated because of the main institutional response of Colombia against cocaine is aerial spraying of herbicides. And you know, guys, this promote more deforestation because the forest remnants are just killed with this herbicide. And the cocaine growers move from targeted areas to other places and start deforesting again. And it's a snowball like that. These are some mud floods in this region caused by all these landslides. Well, there is a nice, sorry that this may be not readable up there, but there is a nice recent paper on forests, the connection between cocaine and deforestation in the Northern Andes. And look at the results of all forest law in the Northern Andes due to cocaine. Well, we are working right now on a Pacific river called Patia, and this is the... It's too clear, but okay, in green are some pixels. All these pixels show cocaine, deforested humid forest, and cocaine crops. So it's interesting that during the 70s and the 80s in this river, the government gave many licenses to clear cut many forests. Actually, 60% of the wood production in Colombia came from this river. So after removing all forests in this time, a lot of erosion because of deforestation, after removing all the forests, only this region had approximately 60 sawmills in the region. Today, only one sawmill remains. So all forests were gone. And then you got economic down in the region during the 80s and 90s. No wood, no forests. And then cocaine came and more erosion. This is a very approximate correlation. It's not well proved, but could be. This is the report of the World Bank. Can you imagine that the other institutions besides the environmental institutions in Colombia make good reports about our environment, not us? Well, this is an exquisite report on the environmental priorities to reduce poverty in Colombia by the World Bank. Mm. They mention, for example, that the impact of erosion or soil erosion could cost in Colombia $3 billion per year. They say that this is a bias, this number is too biased because we don't have information. We don't have assessments on erosion. We don't consider erosion in our minds, in our environmental issues. We don't have it. Okay, this is the last assessment on deforestation, on global deforestation. It's called FRA, a Forest Resources Assessment. Made by FAO. FAO is Food Agricultural Organization of the United Nations. I recommend to check out this. This is a great database of deforestation global. It goes at each country level and so on. Let's see, Brazil accounts for half of the global deforestation. Brazil alone accounts for 50% of the global deforestation. If you remove Brazil and Indonesia, you get that Colombia goes into the top six countries in deforestation. This is a value. I just plotted this value into these guys, but this is the last deforestation assessment in Colombia published by the government last year, or socialized by the government last year. So our deforestation is roughly 340,000 hectares per year. This is roughly half of Texas every year, roughly, okay? So Colombia represents only 0.8% of the global surface, but contributes with 5% of the global deforestation. Oh, five is too low. No, it's not too low. It's one order of magnitude higher than the area. New reports in Colombia, for example, 5 million hectares in the last two decades of desertification. The media is quite concerned about the problem. This is illegal mining. This is a tough problem right now. Well, what do we have? Increased production, resource, soil resilience, mass movement, sediment deposition, reduced increasing flood trends. And the last statement I want to make is that if our working hypothesis is correct, it should have many important consequences at the policy-making level, because in addition to consider climate change, we should consider land use change and human impact in our policies of mitigation and adaptation. I'm not going to talk about this. These are some values, global values, about the erosion rates caused by human or by natural processes. One order of magnitude higher the human compared to natural processes. Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. This is a exquisite piece of work of assessment by United Nations. Conclusion, we have altered ecosystems in the last 50 years more than in any geological period. This is one of the last issues of National Geographic. This is from Millennium. We are kind here in 7 billion people. We just came 7 billion a few months ago, 3 or 4 months ago. But what about agriculture? This is from Millennium Ecosystem. We have converted to cropland in 30 years more than 150 years before. This is a nice map of fertility, of soil fertility, based on Cornell University, published in National Geographic. 7 billion people depend on 11% of the global soils. And only we have 3% of fertile soils on Earth right now. Well, these are some projection models of cultivated land, agricultural land, in developing region and industrialized region, according to United Nations. Look at the projections. So we developing countries are the ones supposed to feed 9 billion people within the next 30 years. Well, it has a cost. Agricultural expansion accounts for 96% of deforestation cases in Latin America. This is based on Geist and Lamban. This is a nice article published in Bioscience. Okay, finally, a point I want to make. In our countries, we scientists live in closed boxes, which means we are making our science papers and blah, blah, blah. But we have no connection with policymakers. No connections at all. There is a nice quotation by Luna Leopold, famous geomorphologist. He was the director of USGS here in the United States, and it's a story by Bombeed. Bob Mead, and he told all his crew at the USGS, okay, guys, you just go out, make good science, publish papers, and society will use that. Sometime we'll use that. And here is the way it works in the States, because all universities, labs, and so on, have contracts with the government and make studies, applied studies, and so on. But in our countries, we don't have that connection. Actually, our NSF doesn't have any database of, okay, have we financed a project dealing with soil erosion and that? Oh, I don't know. We don't have that information. I don't know. We lost that. Actually, we have many projects in Colombia funded many times under different titles. So the same problem statement is funded many times. And we have no connections with policymakers. This is a quite nice figure from Millennium, which means, okay, we make research, we establish monitoring systems, but we give this information, we make the connection with policymakers. And this is the part we are missing in many Latin American countries, from my own experience. This is the last one. Think about this feedback. Demographic growth. Is climate change? I don't think so. Demographic growth, food demand, soil conversion, deforestation, ecological deterioration, poverty, and then it goes again. This is a satellite image in between Haiti and Dominican Republic. One country chose to keep their soils, chose to conservation and adaptation, while the other one chose desertification, which means poverty, something like that. We have published, for those who are interested in more further reading, we have published many international peer-reviewed papers about rivers and deltas and erosion in Colombia. Some books available in the AFIT University Press. I want to mention that we have had, although I criticize them, I have had many fans from them.
But not the same fans.
Exactly. So this is the Conciencias, our NSF. I have got many grants from them. This is the Port Authority of Colombia, also a huge sponsor. The Colombian Navy. I want to mention Professor Latrubez's project of PROSUL, which is a comparative study of large alluvial systems in Colombia, in South America, called PROSUL, which is funded by CNPq and related to UNESCO project of Professor Latrubez's tropical rivers. And we have been part of the LOICS, Land Ocean Interaction in the Coastal Zone, a program of the IGBP International Council of Science, and members of the scientific steering committee of that project. Right now, as a part of this Thinker Professorship, and together with the host department of geography and the environment, we are working, Professor Latrouez and myself and some students, to come with a database of erosion for the whole Andean rivers of South America, from Colombia down to Argentina and Chile, and maybe see the role of Andean rivers on global erosion. So that's one of our challenges right now. We have many other challenges. As Professor Hale mentioned in a message a few days ago, it's a kind of a opportunity to launch LILA's environmental initiative, because there is a lot of work in Latin American countries, and one of them is environmental challenges. So thank you very much. Keep in mind this quote from James Hansen: short-term elections that diminish concern about long-term consequences, meaning the way our politicians think about the long run, the future. We just think in short terms, 5 years. That's all. But we need to make these guys believe that we have to think in the long run. Okay? Projections, future, scenarios. What's going to happen if we keep going with this land degradation and so on and so on? What are going to be the cost? What is going to be the cost of this erosion in 50 years? Are we willing to pay that? Okay, thank you very much. Sorry, we started some 12:20 or something like that. So.
Thank you, Reverend. If we can stay a few minutes, have some questions and discussion. Are you willing to receive some questions?
Will be more than welcome.
I just want to thank Juan for a great presentation and thank everybody for making it possible for you to be here. My question is regarding is there anybody listening in Colombia to this issue? Is there any programs, even small scale programs, dealing with the issue of erosion? I mean, are communities concerned about it? I mean, my experience in the working with this same issue in the Caribbean is not until a resource is impacted by that. In my case, it's coral reefs. Mm-hmm. So the agency, the federal agency that deals with that, is the one that provides the funds, or if communities, in this case fisheries, are impacted by erosion getting into the reefs and it's reducing the capacity of the reefs to provide for the fishes. It's not until that happens you get a critical mass of people, community members or agencies that are able to raise the concern and then make it possible, and basically making it possible means of coming up with the money, the funds to deal with it. So is there any, do you see that in Colombia, even on a small scale, people trying to improve, I mean, not only the scientists, but also people dealing with management of the research?
Good question, Carlos. Actually, the guy I showed in one of the slides, this is a president of the former Bank of Colombia, who is in charge of this Colombia Humanitaria, these institutions of adaptation and mitigation of natural disasters. The one that is going to administer the whole funds for this. That guy is close to the president of my university, close friend. This is the way things work in our countries, okay? So, I was invited by some ministers and the government in January this year, after these worst floods occurred and so on, and there was a huge forum, environmental forum, with ministers and so on, and I was supposed to bring the open talk from ministers, and I showed many things like this, and some stronger. And I was kind of very critical, and then some ministers called me and said, Juan, why don't you start leading a regional project of the Northern Andes to get a picture of what's going on before we start using all these funds? Then the president of the university told me, okay, wakey-wakey, get a proposal to these guys. So we did a lot of lobbying during these 6 past months. I went to all these guys in Bogota, by meetings and so on. So they are right now with open-minded with this, and they many of them, not ministers, not the current ministers, but the ones that are running these agencies, they are very open-minded that we need an assessment of what's going on, and we need to project that in the future in terms of making policies against land deterioration. And they are very open-minded right now. So hopefully, we could get those funds
to start a multi-billion, multi-million project for the whole region with economists, with the geologists, with hydrologists, with GIS people, with database people. It's a big, big, big group of people. So we already presented that, and they are open-minded towards that. That could be the beginning of getting monitoring, assessment, and so on, and programs against erosion in Colombia. That could be one of them.
Have two questions, right?
Well, I was more basically along those lines is how do you get this policy discussion going? And one, if you look at the United States, where there has been that relationship between the scientific community and government agencies, where right now we are reducing the impact of the EPA and that sort of thing, where even with this exchange of information, the basic need, immediate need of industry or population has superseded that. So if you go to Colombia, if you can get that dialogue going, how do you even get policy move beyond the extreme need of the population?
Boy, yes, Carolyn. Actually, in our proposal, not my proposal, our proposal, because it's an interdisciplinary group, an interinstitutional group, in our proposal, one of the main results we want to make is some recommendations to the Ministry of Environment in Colombia and to the National System of Environment, because we have a national system. We have many regional corporations in charge of different regions, but the top is the SENA, which is the National System of Environment. That committee is in charge of environmental policies. So one of our results, suggested results, is to give a special report on how, on which policies we should go on soil protection and land conversion and so on. So it's there. I'm not the one writing that policies, but we have people right now who are willing to work on writing policies against erosion and land conversion and so on. So it's not numbers and science and graphs like this and maybe nice results saying that, yes, we have the economic indicators are controlling erosion. No, we need to give them some bullets, you know,
yes,
and major recommendations, yes.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Two questions. One was, what's an example of one of the recommendations? A lot like practical solutions and preventative measures that will deal with hopefully resolving some of the deforestation and erosion issues. Then also, the second question is sort of different. Since visual data tends to elicit the biggest response, is there a data that is there a graph that directly correlates erosion or compares erosion sort of transposes? Could you transpose the graph to erosion to compare erosion and human activities like the deforestation and cocaine crops? So it's like one large graph, and it's got the, and it sort of compares the trends directly, where you can sort of just transpose it there, and then that way you can see that it is due to human activity versus precipitation. Is there just one graph available?
That is a tough one. Actually, the later one, before I forget it, the later question is depending on which scale are you working on.
Okay.
It depends on the scale. But the first, in an assessment like this, you get the whole picture of the whole region. And then, once you identify hot spots, you make a downscale or zoom in, select that region, and then, depending on the pixel, you can overlap indicators with land conversion, but depending on the scale. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay. And the first one, I
The first one, excuse me, I missed that.
Practical. What are some examples of solutions or practical or preventative measures, practical solutions to erosion? Like, for instance, you know that that mining is going to occur, and other industrial events are going to occur. Some certain human activities are going to happen. Well, rather than saying, "Well, stop it, we're destroying, you know, the soil," what solutions?
That reminds me. I was a fellow chief of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and we were in a workshop in Prague with a top guy telling us, it was a nice course, several days, teaching us how to talk to politicians. And this is a nice one, because one of the main recommendations is that you don't tell politicians many things, no more than five. They won't keep the 5 things. And also, don't tell politicians, "You should do this." They hate that. "You should go there. You should stop doing this. We should stop mining. We should stop this." They don't like that. You should tell politicians, "Okay, this is the issue, and we have many ways to face it. If we face it in this way, we will get these results. If we face it in this way, we get this one." They love that. They love the menu. And in terms of that question, is that
you've got the issue of
we cannot tell right now the colonial government stop mining.
Yeah.
They are bringing Canadian companies, Australian companies. They won't eat that. We cannot tell them stop. But we can start at the small scale, working with communities and regional governments, and make them change their behavior and also some politics in each region. Like an example in a different scale, like here in California, for example. The way Californians are facing climate change, and so on, and so on, and so on. So once you work with communities and local governments, and so on, could be one of the strategies of that. Also, agricultural practices, because the agricultural sector in Colombia is very open-minded right now to improve agricultural practices against soil deterioration, and so on. So that could be nice sponsors to work with, and then. It takes time.
Actually, my question was right on this point. On these, I thought it was a terrific talk and terrific this point at the end about how so much depends on communication and who you communicate with and how the message gets out. And I just feel like this idea of talking to policymakers, it seems. I mean, that's the one part of the model that, and you just said it. It seems. I mean, that's part of the flaw. And politicians are never going to be the ones to... They're always going to be weighing 3 or 4 different short-term pressures versus your long-term scenario, right? And so if it's not the fisher people who are being affected directly, or communities, or social movements, or if it's not the people that are putting the politicians in power, then we're always going to be left with that menu, and they're going to choose the wrong thing, right? And so isn't, and I guess the question that's behind that is, isn't it a much bigger shift in terms of the approach of scientists to this problem? In other words, it seems like it's in the comfort zone of scientists to talk to policymakers, because that's okay, you know, even if it's only 5 points. But is it in the comfort zone to connect science to grassroots politics? Who does that? I mean, what are the paradigms for doing that?
Who does that?
Could we do that? I mean, could you do that? I mean,
I am starting doing that.
Great.
I am starting doing that because I realized that what is the purpose of all these signs? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is? I mean, you see that the whole country is a mess. You see that places that were so nice places are just mess right now. But you are making signs inside. And then I realized that I will fight for this. I realized that just 6 months ago. I'm not quite an expert talking to politicians, but I just realized that. And I got other colleagues joining me and said, let's go for it. So what I'm doing is that I'm using political relationships, connections, important ones, just to present to the president. Man, there is a crazy professor there, Afid called Restrepo. Yeah, yes. What's that guy do is now he's kind of in our committees and okay, keep going. So, and we are doing kind of network of relationships and connection, an interesting one. Not with money, I want to make clear that. But yeah, we're using connections. And it's working. It seems to be working.
I think a key thing, and that's either working with the government or community, is finding the issue that concerns them.
Uh-huh.
So exactly. And that's a question that I wanted
yes,
to
thank you,
Carlos. This is like fishing. I mean, what are you doing with the hook?
Yes.
For the politicians, what would be the hook? I mean, is it natural disasters the issue for them?
It's a natural one. It's a natural.
But is it the disaster issue or environment?
No, it's not the environmental one. They are eating the disaster issue. But if you connect the disaster issue with the environmental issue,
they will get it.
You know, that's the connection. Yeah. They are so interested in the flood stuff and the disaster stuff. They are not interested in mining and soils and that. But the point we want to make is the connection to prove that the trigger is human activities on those natural disasters. And not climate change. Carlos, to interrupt you, but it's not climate change. The point is that we are arguing climate change. Colombia contributes 0.4% of the carbon emissions worldwide. 0.4%. We have no muscle to discuss climate change in the international committees. You know.
I have two questions. Go ahead.
Going back to what you were saying before with the politicians and not being interested in dealing with mining and such. Do they understand the connection between deforestation and erosion? And if so, are there currently any programs to address reforesting?
Oh,
I know you've got committees working on impact and such, but like, is reforesting going on in say the herbicide treated lands, or is that being reclaimed by something else? Like farming or ranching. I mean, I guess it's hillside, so not ranching, more farming, but
I don't know. Thank you, Jennifer. Actually, yes, there is a program going on identifying many hot spots or places to be reforested. Mm-hmm. So there is an important plan, national plan for reforestation, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's there.
Yeah, it was a great talk, and I want to commend you for being a natural scientist who can talk to other people, because, you know, even the non-scientists among us could understand what you were saying. But one of the things that struck me about the talk, what you were saying, is that in the U.S. context, for example, we tend to see the problem in terms of is one of denying climate change, right? It's like the people who deny the import that it's even happening, right? So it's like, you know, the Texas or governor in Texas who doesn't think climate change is actually happening. So it's interesting to see how in actually the, you know, accepting the existence of climate change can be a problem or be used to then not deal with this issue of the perils of human activity in a different context.
So, and the question is, could your talk be used to could Governor Perry use your talk for climate change denial?
At one point, you can make that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, any idea?
I was thinking that same thing. It's a tough
one. Yes.
Good point.
Why can't you say, why does the discourse have to be, it's not climate change?
But, yeah.
I mean, I understand the precipitation, but why can't you say it's both?
Or that this is an contributing factor to climate change.
The magnitude of the event
change
is there. You had an incredible event that happened at that time, so you know that it could happen again. So I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's climate change or not. It's possible in Colombia, so you got to adapt to that condition. So.
Yeah, I see this as a comment. There is a problem with the, we mentioned the same thing on this stuff. So climatic change is part of this. There is another terminology that is most important. It is global change. So global change includes all this stuff plus climatic change. So this is a problem of global change. The problem is that in the last year we have been listening a group of people just working with modeling in terms of climatic change. But the global change is a bigger issue and exists in the discussion before this problem. And you mentioned the Anthropocene and all this stuff. So we need to retake the global change discussion because all this is global change and you are part of this. I think that's the point.
It's global, but it manifests itself locally. So it's got a local manifestation.
Yeah,
like
of global change, exactly.
Yeah. But then there's this political question of what you've got, this enormous kind of public opinion and global apparatus focused on climate change. So do you, is the proposal to shift the public understanding and shift the politics from climate change to
global change
and include human, and that's a
dimension.
And this was also in UNESCO and United Nations, global change program was for that. And many of our programs are mentioned here are global change, are not climatic change.
No, and there is a program going on, which is IHDP, International Human Dimension Program, by the IGVP, and it's linked with the United Nations program, UNEP, and so on. So there is a program of human dimension on climate change and global change. Yes, there are many. But the question for politicians, the choice between climate change and soil conversion or soil degradation is this. Could be this one. Let's say the cost of dredging, rivers in Colombia, dredging. So there is a huge program, a huge project to make the Magdalena River ready for navigation from the mid-basin up to the ocean, because we have a lot of troubles with our roads in Colombia, because our mountain roads with many geological faults and, the maintenance of those roads are very expensive. Actually, the ton in our truck system in the region for income, export, and so on, for moving the economic stuff, it's one of the most expensive ton per kilometer in the world. So the cost in our transportation is very, very high.
So they are arguing to put our rivers, to navigate our rivers, and the cost will be maybe 10 times less than the cost in trucks. But they haven't, but they became with some beautiful numbers of the ton in on ships on the river, along the river. I said, oh, it's 10 times cheaper than And then I found out that they got that number with some from some European rivers and from the Paraná River in, down there in Argentina. And if you go to some regions in the Paraná, El Tarto has taken me there, it's almost drinkable water, not sediments at all. Of course, you don't dredge those rivers, which are the indirect costs of dredging those rivers to keep it functional and so on.
Sediment sink in the middle will go away as well, right? You sink, they were talking about that flat area, that depression area that you were talking about, that'll probably go away as a sediment retention.
Exactly. What is the time life of that region? And what is the associated cost of those of this huge amount of sediments in the rivers and the dredging programs to keep them clean? Mm-hmm. So it's not climate change. They is soil stuff.
Another one.
When you talk about money.
Yeah.
Whether it's climate change or erosion, I think the underlying factor is convenience and what we're living to live with or without, supply and demand, and that's what hurts. It hurts everybody. Mm. You know, and so if we can get to that issue, which is like, yeah, when we want to touch it, we should put a huge sticker on it and call it climate change, or, you know, and we don't want to really down to the nitty gritty, you know, what the issue is, what we're willing to live with or without, you know, so, and getting, I think, maybe communities to see, okay, this is the impact of us pushing, you know, overusing resources, you know, how can we adjust it, and that's, I don't even want to, you know, think about some of those issues when, you know, there's conveniences. You know, I'm like, I don't want to live without, but, you know, but you have to.
As you were mentioning during the conference of Diana Lieberman about the fluorocarbons, for example, when it's about regulation, it's about adaptation, it's about what? When we think about fluorocarbons and all the odorants and the cooling systems and so on, back then in the 70s, it looked almost impossible that the whole world would come up with another technology and replace the fluorocarbons, and we did it.
But it was under the pressure of something major happening.
Yes, but I'm quite optimistic because it takes time. It's not that we are going to make this project and the next day everything is going to be beautiful. But if we keep knocking the door and going and going and going and going, maybe probably we will get there in 50 years, maybe. In 50, yeah. But at least in 50.
Yeah, at least in 50.
Someone has to do
it.
No, you will. You will. You will. I bet you will. No, you will. You're a sporty guy. You will. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.